I'm Wayne.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Stargate Pioneer from the Starling Tribune.
A podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3,
2,
1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 149 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we jump into our time machine, cleverly disguised as a phone booth, visit historical figures with no caring about how exposing them to the concept of time travel might change their established lives, and we ensure a happy outcome for the clearly most beloved of all species in the galaxy, humans. Oh, and we might talk about some Doctor Who as well. I am your host, Keir, and with me in the GPR studios, as always, is my partner in time, Jay. How are you, sir?
Keep trying to make a phone call, and I don't know what's going on here.
You got to hit both bottom buttons at the same time, the pound sign and the infinity symbol. And over there is Haley. Haley, how are we tonight?
What is a phone booth?
Oh, that's a generational thing.
Young kid humor. So this week we continue our time travel arc and have a most excellent adventure with the 1989 movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. We explore the concepts of set timelines that we can influence so that they stay the same, even if we don't know it yet. We promise it'll make sense in about 3 days. Just bear with us.
Okay. Well, there's special places in our hearts, and I'm speaking on Jay and my behalf here because of generationally, this is one of our, you know, our teenage year comics. Oh, yeah. So it has that particular echelon. Haley, I know you're fond of it. It just became one of those things where look how stupid they were back.
No,
in the late
this 80s. Movie has existed for my entire life. It has always been a part of my life. I remember watching this on cable all the time as a kid. All the time.
So she is of the Wild Stallions generation.
But back when it was cool to spell everything with a Y instead of an I.
Yeah, Lynyrd Skynyrd. Striper. But I'm just going to put this out here right now, because I know what our points of discussion tonight to really kind of take apart some of the things like the mechanics of time travel and how it's facilitated, some of the dangers and pitfalls and how they deal with them. None of those things really have anything to do with this film. Just be aware, as much as you know it to be a time travel film, that's just your entry pass. And beyond that point, it's just a goofy comedy. So
pretty much, yeah.
That being said, what things do they actually tether back to actual time travel that we can point to and say, all right, here are their touch points.
You say, you know, it's goofy and they don't really care about the consequences, but it does have my favorite time travel mechanic of all time, or theory, I guess, of time travel, which is that no matter what you do, the course of events is already set.
Right.
Like, they go around and goof off and do all sorts of crazy shenanigans, but they're not influencing the time stream because what they've done has already happened.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of the, I mean, you can sum up the entire philosophy of, you know, how you impact time in 4 words. Remember the trash can. I mean, it's, you know, you see everything play out exactly as it normally would. It's just that, oh, well, that's because it tied into this and there's that. And it's, and yeah, like Haley said, it's time is set. You're just, you know, giving it the chance to do so, basically. I don't know. It's,
Right. Everything that you know to have transpired or everything that is transpiring is doing so because it has always been that way and will always be that way, immutable.
Right. And so, if some random trash can drops out of the ceiling, well, that's because clearly in the future you have to go back in time and set that up because that's just how it worked out.
But right. You have to remember to go back and do it or it won't happen.
I totally did steal my dad's keys.
Right. So this takes the alternate timeline theory and just poops on it because the timeline is the timeline. And whether you succeed or fail at everything that you're attempting to do along the way has already been predetermined.
Right.
So if that's the case, my personal favorite, you know, going back and because I used to watch this thing maybe once a year or once every, you know, 18 months or so, just for ha-has. Just it's one of those, I can always enjoy it. I can keep it on in the house while I'm doing something else and probably recite it verbatim. Second film, probably more so, just for whatever reason. But with this, you know, certain things, just if you're tuned in to try, as I did on this most recent rewatch, to really try and see what they were attempting to do to justify or quantify the mechanisms that they were doing. The best thing you get is Rufus's line when they first start traveling in the booth. And then, you know, how do you do all this, Rufus? And he just says, modern technology, kids. That's it.
Yeah.
Modern technology. Yeah. I hit my head. I dreamed of the flux capacitor.
It's, you know, technology advances to a point where clearly you want, you know, time travel is a logical inevitability, apparently.
Correct. So it's working in reverse. If you want something to be, just remember that it's going to have to be invented later and then you've got it. So yeah. it's a great vehicle to accomplish what they wanted to with this thing. Mm. Now, if it's that simple just to explain away the means, what about the methods? So as far as going through the phone book, looking up the code you need to punch in to go to ancient Greece, and bagging Socrates.
It's, you know, I mean, that's kind of the thing that we've run into with Doctor Who a lot, that we kind of complain about at times. It's, oh, well, we want to have a Western episode, so we have a time machine. Let's go to the Wild West. And
flip levers.
Yeah. And I mean, that's basically what it is. It's, they're not impacting time per se in this. It's just, we need historical figures, so we have a time machine. We have historical figures. It just works out that way. Mm-hmm.
But the great thing about it is because it is just an over the top comedy, they don't even feel it necessary to concern themselves with the fact that they are not only affecting these individuals in their own natural mm-hmm. time and place, but pulling them out of it and exposing them to a much larger scope.
Yeah.
I like to think that the reason Joan of Arc was considered a witch is because she went back to medieval France and was like, I went to the future with these guys.
No, met guys, them at a church. Seriously, corn dogs. I'm telling you, corn dogs. That's where we go.
Jazzercise.
Aerobics class. Come on, guys. It's all Bill and Ted's fault.
this movie just took a dark turn.
They credit Billy the Kid for being able to handle the rigors of time travel exceptionally well, you know, and as he's stepping out of the film, yeah, well, you know, what are you gonna, just kind of lets it roll. I've always enjoyed the idea of, I like the oral presentation that they were handed, the premise in the first place. You mm-hmm. know, if you were to bring historical figures from these eras to San Dimas, California of 1988, you know, what would their opinion of the world be? And you listen to some of the things that they're prefacing, and you know, when they come around in the third act, you get a nice little, well, maybe except for some of the elements of the presentation. You know, Genghis Khan's really just there for action sequences and such. But I like the whole idea of using it, and it's something we've done in Doctor Who as well, about taking the outsider's look at what we take for granted right now. You know, whether it be taking someone from the past and exposing them to, you know, our futuristic world of 2015, mm-hmm. or taking one of our modern contemporaries and throwing him or her as the companion into the far-flung future and making them look archaic, you know, against the backdrop of everything that they've been exposed to 100, 1,000, 10,000 years hence. Right. So that's a fun convention.
Yeah, and I mean, it gave you a reason to have this whole adventure where the, you know, what other purpose is there going to be for them, for these two surfer guys just to randomly hop through time, picking up people left and right? It worked very well for the story. Like, the story actually holds up if you give it that preface. You know, otherwise it is just, how goofball can we make this with what names can we drop, you know?
Mm-hmm. And the fact, please note that by the time they get towards the close of preparations for the report, they're stuffing 9 people in the phone booth. Got to be bigger on the inside.
They're standing in it like it's a rowboat.
Because, I mean, by the time, just in the first couple pickups, when they've got Socrates and Billy the Kid, there's 4 of them in there, and they're already struggling to get in and out of the door.
I'm just going to throw this out there. It took me longer than it should have to figure out who you meant when you said Socrates.
Oh, sorry. The Socratic method, you know. If it weren't for such people as Joan of Arc, Napoleon, and Socratic method.
You know, I love the fact that, you know, quote-unquote modern technology can be repaired with Hubba Bubba and, like, Vienna sausage cans.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they need such a huge wad of gum to just hold that one piece on there?
The
that is not good Bubba engineering.
And you have to let it dry out a bit, too. You can't use it immediately after it's been chewed. Right,
no,
it's all
then it's just gonna drip.
No, it's just, yeah, it's snotty. You got to wait a second.
There's probably a formula for the amount of time you have to wait per ABC wad of gum. Oh, boy. Yeah.
All right, I think the rails are way back there.
Okay, well, what kind of grading system does this teacher have that they can flunk the entire class and then have somebody else show up for their report and do the talking, and they pass?
Yeah. How is the grading scale that just one oral report at the end of the semester, end of the school year, is enough to pull an F to a D?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they failed, like 59% failed on everything, and then this is the big, huge final project, but I don't think they got 59%.
No. Not if you ask them about their theories about the salad dressing dude. I got to say, you know, going back and looking at the early days of Keanu and Alex Winter as well, who I'm hoping is not completely dropped off the face of the earth at this point. I mean,
no, he's going to be in Bill and Ted 3.
But
yeah, that's happening.
That's in development hell. Yeah. So, but for teen actors at the time, for how dopey the script was, they sold it, you know, as far as like facial expressions when they're being flat out told by every adult around them that they're idiots,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they just kind of, yeah, they just got to shake their heads and accept it. We really are dumb as a box of rocks and just accept it. It's one of my favorite, extremely stupid, so bad it's good films. Has to be. And then the fact that, you know, at the time, you know, the music they were emulating, that's what I was listening to back in high school. I was listening to the metal bands and so forth. So that all kind of tied into, I don't think I ever dressed like that though. I don't think I ever tied so many sweatshirts around my waist and, no, with the vests. And,
you never had the vest over the t-shirt?
I did have the vest over the t-shirt, but not with shorts over sweatpants and then another sweatshirt tied around. They were all about layers in San Dimas, apparently.
Yeah, because, you know, it gets frigid in June in California.
Right. I think, how long did they wait before the second film was, what, like 5 years later or so? I want to say it was like 94 or so, 93 maybe.
I don't know.
But, so they
I'm not
going to
lie. I didn't know the second film existed until like 6 years ago.
Wow. Okay.
I'd say you're better off, but you know.
I liked it.
It's perfectly acceptable.
It was following the same kind of premise we get with a lot of these films. You do something outlandish in the first one, and you still want to do outlandish things, but you got to flip it. So, you know, we traveled time before. Now we've got to go to the afterlife.
Right. I mean, this was back in the day when, you know, oh, hey, look, our movie's a success. Let's try it again and see if we can get more money out of it instead of the, well, we can't make this movie because there's no chance of turning it into a franchise. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a completely different method back then. And so you did wind up with the, well, we had this goofball comedy, so let's try and ratchet it up another level. And oh, crap, it failed.
Well, as far as the some of the connections we can make between what they've toyed around with in this film and what we know and love from the Hooniverse, obviously we've got, as we mentioned in the intro, there's a lot of, you know, direct comparisons. You can grab some of the elements.
Yeah.
Or were there anything outside of obviously their mechanism of travel, the some of their means of transplanting people out of their own time in order to either intensify or in this case yuck it up for the experience? Or were there any other things that you saw that were okay? No, I see where that's connected in some way to some of the things we've done in Doctor Who.
I don't know. I could just remember the times that I will admit to having slapped someone for trying to explain Doctor Who to them. And when I get to the he travels around time in a phone booth looking thing, oh, you mean Bill and Ted's? And you know, instinct reaction kick takes over, and yeah, there was physical harm. I mean, well, but it's—I don't know. I mean, there's—it's two completely different premises here. You know, you've got something that tries to take itself a little bit seriously, at least you know, most of the time, and tell compelling stories, and then you have this goofball comedy that's just, you know, how can we get one more laugh out of the audience? You know,
right. Right. Well, I do note that, you know, we were talking about the whole idea of the linear path of time and setting up setting yourself up for actions and sequences and cause and effect that has to happen later, you know, leaving the car keys, the trash can, the so forth. There have been, with all of the ways that Doctor Who has played with the repercussions of time manipulation over the decades, there have been episodes where that direct line of action has been taken as well. You know, think Matt Smith and his mop and everything going through Pandora and Big Bang, you know, setting up instances and popping just out, you know, back and forth often enough, you know, asynchronously in order to make sure that the series of events takes place as planned.
Yeah. But see, I mean, that's the kind of thing is the different levels that you have between Doctor Who and Bill and Ted's. If you look at Bill and Ted's, this is a world. This is a realistic view of what time travel would be like, in my opinion, I think, because this is a world where paradoxes cannot exist. You know, the tape recording, you know, when, you know, they're like, we need to get a tape recorder and set it up. What am I going to say? And then instantly it starts going. And it's like, well, you know, this is exactly how it's going to play out. There's no chance of him saying anything, you know, even, you know, changing the inflection on a single word, because clearly it has already happened. And so this is a world where, you know, things happen a specific way, and that is exactly how they're going to happen, regardless of whether you try and change it or not. So trying to, you know, translate that into Doctor Who, which is, you know, has never managed to pull that off. You know, even the instance you gave with Matt Smith and his mop and the Fez, and that was while the world was being torn apart because of a paradox, you know, So it's one of those things you can't really try and push that onto Doctor Who.
Right. Well, there's the warning that Rufus gives them at the outset, you know, at their Circle K discussion about winding his watch and remembering that the clock is always running in San Dimas of 88.
That didn't make sense.
Exactly. And that's one of the only things that I'm looking at. I'm like, they made a point of really, like, they pulled the brake before handing you the time machine. He says the clock is always running. But one of the first things they start doing within, you know, the start of the second act is overlapping their own timeline.
Right. Well, and then in the second movie, they take a year and a half to go learn how to play music and then just pop back in.
Right. I think what they were attempting to say was, don't forget that you have to come back to this event.
Well, yeah, but why couldn't they just have, you know, parked in the Circle K that night, gone, taken a nap before their big report?
Well, I think that what it sounds like to me is, you know how we discussed with Back to the Future last week, how, you know, when you leave, when you time travel, you cease to exist in that reality. And this is saying, no, reality is set. Yes, you can go back and you can go over your own timeline, but that is not where you are supposed to exist. That is not where you are linked to in space-time. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, you're basically, I can drive to the store, but that is not where I live. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. This is an actual form of travel instead of time travel kind of thing. So it was a way of saying, you know, you are linked to this specific time. You can bounce around and stuff and you can go visit these other places, but you don't cease to exist in your timeline. Like your spot is held for you. Somebody is holding your seat waiting for you to come back because this is always where you're going to be.
Hmm. Okay.
Mm, I think it's a good attempt at justifying it, but I think the movie was just broken there. Because I guess it's not broken in that one as much as it is in the second one when they take 16 months and then just pop back in the time stream like nothing happened.
Right. Because at that point, apparently, yes, the clock is running, but you're not bound to that clock.
I guess it doesn't matter when you... you know what? That doesn't work because they pulled the princesses out of time.
The clock is always running there, but it's not running in 14th century France.
Right. They didn't have accurate timepieces then, so it's fine.
No, the hourglass is not running.
Like sands through the hourglass.
Well, but I mean, at that point, the princesses would just have been considered dead. I mean, the whole thing was that Rufus was telling them, you have to come back to your time. You have to be a part of these events in order for the future to happen as it's supposed to.
Right. Well, that's why I was saying that really what he was, you could have paraphrased and just say, don't forget to come back and actually do the report.
Yeah.
Because that sets everything in motion.
Well, I'm sorry for getting pedantic. Jeez. No one's ever been guilty of that in this fandom. Jeez.
I think we're all in agreement. We just kind of came at it from different sides.
Right, right.
No, so essentially the movie's a complete pile of crap.
It's garbage. I don't know why we watched it. Jeez.
So many times.
I'd be lying. We're going
to watch it again just to explain why it sucks.
I would be lying if I said that this whole arc wasn't just an excuse to kind of watch these movies.
That's probably true. But then from a continuity standpoint, all right, so they go out and they travel in the final closing moments there. They go off and they practice for, you know, 16 months and come back and he's got the, you know, ZZ Top beard. And all of a sudden, you know, Ted looks like, Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters and whatnot. And they got babies in their back and whatnot. So all this stuff happens. And yet when you see future them, like when you're off, you know, whatever it is, 800 years in the future or so, 600 years, the hologram of them up on the wall slowly doing the air guitar swing, mm-hmm. and they look like they did when they were just starting, just wearing big ass right. trench coats.
Well, in all the news clippings they show too, it's the same they've looked the entire movie.
Right. So apparently they just, while they were off, you know, doing their sort of Eagles rehearsal
doing their
sessions.
Walkabout.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's just filmmaking decisions at that point. Mm. I'm sorry to, you know, break up our time travel discussion, but...
The closing credits montage is, like, one of the best parts of the film, though.
Yeah, I'll have to give you that one.
Yeah. Well, what are we going to do? You said that you would set up this entire arc so that we could basically watch, you know, your favorite non-Whovian time travel film. So, but the one that we're going to be wrapping up with is technically... Of Whovian roots.
It has a link. It does.
A link.
All right. So next week, we're going to talk about frequently asked questions about time travel, which may have been pinned by a Doctor Who writer. But he wasn't at the time, though. Like, this was before he actually wrote for Doctor Who, wasn't it? This was before New Who came back, I think.
No.
Was it?
I think FAQ was only about... timestamp because I'm about to go check IMDb and
that's
I'm going to say
exactly what I'm doing right now.
I want to say it was
2009. Four. Okay. Yeah. So yes, it was before he wrote for Doctor Who.
Mm, but clearly already had his mind tuned on things of temporal manipulation.
Well, I mean, they give it a straight call out, but we'll talk about that next week.
Yep. So, and we're going to try to reach out to Jamie Matheson this week and see if he can, you know, grace us with a couple of words about our horrible, horrible send up that I'm sure we'll do. We'll apologize in advance to him and see if he gives us his blessing.
I have to say, as much as I've enjoyed revisiting these blasts from the past, this is the one that I'm most excited about going back and revisiting under this lens. This is the one that I'm excited about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because this is one that really plays with the science.
Yeah.
Or in this case, theoretical science.
The smience.
Smience.
All right. Well, we ready to get into some news?
Yeah, we got a good amount of it. Let's do it.
Yay, news. Woot. So some, you know, as we're getting closer, we're now within, what, three weeks?
Three weeks.
Yeah, we're within 3 weeks of Series 9, and still, they tease us with new things. Mm-hmm. The first of which that we'll talk about is some new pictures that we got.
Yeah, so interesting observation we were discussing before the cast started. So, kids, you thinking about cosplaying Peter Capaldi at your next local Whovian convention or geek gathering of interest? Here's what you got to do.
Just get dressed, put on a coat.
Done. You might want to wig your hair out a little bit.
I mean, I love this because Capaldi's gone on record talking about like how he chose the design for his costume. And one of the things he said was because, you know, it was easy for fans to emulate. So it's like he's thinking about cosplayers, you know, in not so many words, but like, and you can see that it's just, you know, here's some regular everyday street clothes. You put on the coat and it's the costume, you know. Now, granted, the purple or red velvet looking one that he's wearing now is less imitatable, but still.
Yes, but now that we're, you know, a season and change into the knowledge of it, there have been some good replicators out there that have done a nice job not only making patterns available for those of you who can actually run a sewing machine. I'm not even close to one. I can barely thread a needle. And then some that are actually purchasable, you know, if you want something that looks like a pretty close facsimile, but you don't have that skill.
I mean, it's a lot easier to come by than, say, Colin Baker's jacket, you know.
Yeah.
So it's still pretty awesome, but.
Yeah, the seed of fashion in this thing is clearly still Jenna Coleman and putting her in various outfits to give the cosplaying fan base a lot of variety.
Mm-hmm. I've got to say, Jenna Coleman in a leather jacket, I'm there.
Channeling her Eve Miles, I suppose.
Everyone wears leather jackets now. Leather jackets are cool.
Yeah, but they don't all wear them like Jenna Coleman does.
I don't know. Have you seen Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? They all wear them like she does, I think.
That's probably true. We've had, since Comic-Con, Capaldi has been given the opportunity or has been given permission to at least make very guarded statements and Q&As with various magazines and online resources about his reflection on the closing of production on Series 9 and maybe not necessarily what we're going to expect, but what his opinions are on what's been cut so far. Has he tipped anything to us that we should be mindful of?
Not that I'm aware of. He's spent a lot of time talking about, I mean, stuff that we've already heard a couple times, you know, about how the Doctor and Clara are much better friends now, and this is more of a happy adventure. You know, he has confirmed that Clara will still be teaching at Coal Hill School, and that's something that he's excited about because it's still tying into the history of the show and things like that. Mm. You know, talking about Michelle Gomez coming back. You know, it's basically just a lot of them saying, okay, but what about this? And him going on to explain how much of a fan of the show he is. And that's pretty much what it all boils down to. It's, you know, let me ask you a question in regards to this. Aren't those great monsters? I love those things. They're fantastic. Moving on.
I do know that he had referenced the visit from Carol Ann Ford. And I watched that particular statement when he was doing this one interview with Den of Geek, saying, you know, he's fascinated by that whole dichotomy, because it is still, and the way he's phrasing it, I get the impression that it's still this great unknown, you know, that has never really been fully worked into the televised canon. So he considers that to be this really fascinating little aspect of the show that has. And again, this is my interpretation of the way that he's phrasing it. Sounds like they are not going to be, at least for the foreseeable future, addressing it any farther. So, because I was always curious, you know, whether they were even going to do another name drop, because they had done a quick kind of name check and such. But whether it was going to go any farther with that, especially with Carol Ann visiting the set this past year. So doesn't look like they're going to try to open that can of worms anytime soon.
Yeah. And I mean, it just keeps on looking like this is one of those things that he sits there and thinks, man, that would be fantastic. And if they came up with, you know, if they said that they were thinking about doing it, I'd enjoy the heck out of it, but I don't see it coming. Like, it's one of those pipe dreams that he has, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he did, he was talking, I know there was an interview he was doing a couple weeks ago where he was talking to, might have been SFX magazine or something. They were talking about the music of Doctor Who, you know, and the fact that he's now, because he apparently his flat is somewhere relatively close to where they do a lot of the orchestral recordings, right? So he gets to every once in a while gets to go in and sit in on from the sound booth and listen to some of the work that Murray Gold and the orchestra are putting together, and you know he gets to listen to his first listen of what his Doctor's theme is to be established. And he's like a kid in a candy store with that sort of thing, because it's now he admits that he actually uses previous season scores that he listens to while he's preparing to drop in a character before shoots begin. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, if you need any more evidence that he is just the biggest fanboy who has gotten the ultimate golden ticket, you know, I can't recall anyone who has been portraying the Doctor of late, or going back as far as I can tell, that is as steeped in the program to begin with as he is.
No, I mean, the closest we've got is David Tennant. And still, even that, it was, he didn't grow up with the show like Capaldi did. I mean, he grew up with the show, but it's
not as much of the show.
Mm. Yeah. And it takes on a whole new meaning for someone like Capaldi. So it's, you're really seeing how it is that, you know, being able to watch this show from inception to the point that it is now, and how that impacts somebody.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you read over this, this Metro article where they decided to, well, threw a bit of a clickbait title in there, grabbed a statement, and now they're bending and flexing the phrasing to try and see if it means what they think it means. About his, you know, when he sees the light at the end of the tunnel, mm-hmm. for his Doctor.
I mean, that's unfortunately, you know, that we do live in a time that the Doctors can't stick around as long as Tom Baker. You know, it's going to be a short run kind of thing. There's, you know, all of them have said that it is a taxing role. It is something that you cannot go on doing for long periods of time. So even only one series in, we're aware that Capaldi's time is going to come to a close at some point in the future. Like, you know, it's something we will see, you know, in our lifetime, basically, you know. And so a lot of people like to play with that, and some people take it to the nth degree and, you know, ask leading questions and then like to twist what comes out of their mouth. And where's the quote exactly?
Well, he was speaking to the Daily Mirror, which, again,
there's a problem.
Yeah, well, but he was actually speaking to them. This right, wasn't right. Just, you know, they, you know, leaned into the room where he was speaking to someone else and grabbed five words out of context. He was speaking directly to them and said, you know, he enjoys the position that he's in with a bit of a melancholy, because it has to come to an end. So at some point, you know. And he said, quote, "I will cross that bridge when we come to it, which may be sooner rather than later," which can mean, you know, well, later could be 5 years, but it could be 2 or 3 years. You know, it could be sooner rather than later. But they look at it as, oh, okay, there's grist for the mill that yeah. we're back to the this is my last year statement.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's a clickbait title. Oh, he said something that could possibly mean this if you tilt your head like this and squint your eyes and hold your tongue at just the right angle. Yeah, it's so it infuriates me that it takes that bend on it instead of just reporting what he said and, you know, letting his statement be what it is, mm-hmm. which is interesting enough in its own right. But no, now you need to turn it that way and try and, you know, get that extra couple clicks off of it, and it just
right. Well, what about some things that we know we've got coming into episode or into series 9 that that we can bank on? You know, we're still getting little tidbits and teasers and official, you know, little gifts from on high, mm-hmm. as we're getting into the last 3 weeks before series 9 airs.
Well, I mean, this is the point where Moffat kind of sits there with his magnifying glass and, you know, starts to fry all the ants and just giggles to himself over the power that he wields. And, you know, he does stuff like gives out 5 teaser words for the series, which apparently means, you know, we get cards, hybrid, cobbles, solo, and dead. Mostly in order. One will make you laugh, the other cry. What? Okay, what? Really? Like,
so. Thanks. Opening credits, action, Scottish joke, running, closing credits.
Yeah.
He did reference, and I've seen this come up in a couple of different reinterpretations of some of his articles, especially his most recent with Doctor Who magazine, explaining the multi-part stories as we've been addressing, as we were finding out more and more about the episodes that were going to be laid out for this series, that there were all these two-parters, and where we were kind of under the impression it was being done because it was sort of a combination of the classic opportunity of telling the story in full. But it's also a matter of, as he phrases it, recapturing mystery and atmosphere. You know, if you've got more time to really tell this ghost story or horror story, interesting that you mentioned ghosts because that's going to be, you know, coming up again. But you have a movie format, you know, now you've got 2 hours to be able to tell your tale in full.
Yeah. And so, I mean, some of the interesting things that we get is he actually did give little teasers about what certain episodes were going to be. And, you know, Kier, like you mentioned, he said that the concept for episodes 3 and 4 was ghosts plus time travel. You know, what if you could meet your own ghost? And then the guest star, Sophie Stone's character, will only speak through sign language in those episodes. And so little bits like this that really don't mean anything to us outside of context, and I'm sure once we get there, it's either going to be one of those like, oh, okay, that all makes sense now, or really, you were just dangling that in front of us, really.
I did think it was interesting when he was discussing Zygons, because, you know, we obviously know that we're going to be seeing them again. It's going to be some way connected with Ingrid Oliver's return and so forth. But with in his mention, he references that Zygons, the idea is that Zygons are living among us, but if they were, what would we do about it? And could it be that these monsters aren't actually monsters at all and are just like us? And that screams in my head about the Big Finish story that involves, you know, the family members that have been represented by Zygons for years and their motives behind doing that. And I have a feeling that we're pulling on some of the same sort of premise. I'm going to throw the Mark Gatiss card out here for Jay's benefit, because according to Moffat's words, his episode 9, which we've got some news about in a related story, he considered to be a kind of a difficult one to pull off production wise and very different to Gatiss's other scripts. So maybe this will mean that Jay can retract the clause and actually.
Nope, I hate it on principle. Sorry. Okay. It's going to suck.
Never mind. I tried. Well, sorry.
No, so, this is interesting news. Apparently, the episode is going to be is shot in the style of found footage. So, you know, think Blair Witch Project, Chronicle, things along those lines, which. Right. The whole found footage thing has gotten a bum rap because a lot of times it gets used for, oh, if we do this, then we can make this movie a lot cheaper. And so they try and cut corners, and it doesn't do anything to enhance the story. It's just a way of saving money or getting a movie out that really shouldn't have been made in the first place because now they can afford to do it. I don't think that that's going to be what the issue is here. I mean, Doctor Who has never done anything just for the sake of doing it because it was the popular thing at the time. You know, if they're deciding that this episode needs to be shot in this style, it's one, there's going to be a good reason for it. And two, they're going to give it their all. Like, it's going to be something that is done well instead of just, let's give 5 guys camcorders and we'll shoot the whole thing or whatever. They're going to put effort into it. And so I think that it's not going to fall into the same traps that typical found footage releases do, which is just, you know, a mediocre story shot horribly just for the sake of getting something out.
I see it being probably closer to something like Blink, and maybe the part that we're seeing that's not the Doctor directly would be told as the found footage style. I don't know how they would do an entire episode found footage style.
I don't know. The only thing that I'm thinking about is, you know, when you think about Dr. Light episodes or ones that are alternate perspective that can potentially, I think of Love and Monsters, because that's obviously, that even has a little bit of that kind of found footage feel to it, yeah, because of, you know, the individual recordings that are being referenced throughout. But I don't think it's, yeah, I think about Chronicle and how that one was very creative in the way that it kept it from actually using a follow camera at any given point. It went from people's personal, you know, mobile phone recording, you know, smartphone videos to CCTV footage to, you know, a passing news crew and their, you know, their on location reports, anything to keep it from being, you know, an actual camera crew in quotes.
Right.
So if it has that kind of thing, or what's the, what's the Monster Attack? Cloverfield.
And that's something that's actually, Brian Minchin has actually talked about and said that it will echo the feel of that, you know, which is just a bunch of people fighting or, you know, running from a monster or whatever the case is. And he even said, we're considering not even having opening titles and just running the footage.
Yeah.
So it's something that they're really putting effort into, but to get, apparently this story has a specific feel, and found footage is the way to accurately represent that.
Right. In which case you can certainly have a doctor in it, but it's just something where the camera doesn't follow him. He just keeps kind of cutting through scenes.
Yeah. Or he's one of the people running around with someone who has a camcorder.
Right.
You know, and the person probably focuses on him a bit, but not 100% of the time. And so, yeah, I'm actually excited about this one. Mm-hmm. Whether the script is going to hold up to it or not, I don't know. But, you know, the thing is, as much as I talk trash and as much as I, you know, have been burned repeatedly, every time I see Gatiss's name on the slate, there's a little bit of me of hope that, like, maybe this time he's going to change it up enough and I'm actually going to like one. And so
I still don't understand how you didn't like Cold War. I'm just baffled by that one.
No,
argument for another time.
Yeah, I don't know. This one, I mean, I'm excited about everything coming in series 9, but now this one has, like, just, it's moved up the ranks. I don't know. I'm looking forward to it.
But there's a little unconfirmed bit I just wanted to throw in here, just because it was something that apparently mentioned in some of his discussions, you know, and thankfully we're getting, and by the way, just for anyone who gets the opportunity to get interviews with the extended production team, thank you for cornering Brian more often and getting him to speak out, because he doesn't mavitsplain. But there was some discussion through the Mirror is bad, the Daily Star, about some things to look forward to as far as potential. And there's, like, I guess you'd call them spoiler aspects to the nature of this particular article, if you take anything with more than a very small grain of salt. But they were discussing things, you know, they were sort of taking apart the latest trailers and saying, okay, looks like we're going to have, you know, such and such. We've got Vikings. We've got these, you know, those large kind of steampunky looking robots that we haven't quite figured out yet. You know, we've got the ghost, we've got the Highwayman, which involves the Maisie Williams character and so forth. And then there's a mention in here that's just kind of thrown in without any real confirmation that we will be seeing two, I'm not going to call them classic villains. They are modern New Who villains who we haven't seen in quite some time. And that would be the Jadoon. And then the Hoth, if you remember, with the, you know, the fish tank,
right,
you know,
from the breeding apparatus, daughter with Donna and Martha. And,
yeah, correct. So I'm thinking that if there is some validity to this, this may be one of those kinds of Pandora kind of moments where there are assembled armies or representatives of species that are all gathering to discuss something.
It's all part of the flashback stuff that's going to tie into the Fires of Pompeii.
There, because, you go.
Yeah, that's why RTD and David Tennant were there. That's how we're going to get it. It's a whole, like, flashback. It's going to take like 10 minutes. And
no, this is how we're going to get the Doctor's daughter back.
Yeah, Georgia Moffat has been, obviously, yep. She's, well, back.
Exactly. She's going to be the one that kind of shows up to explain to the 12th Doctor how it all happened. And yeah.
Or she uses her Time Lady skills to become Maisie Williams. I'm sorry. I smelled toast and rolled back for a minute.
All right. So Christopher Eccleston has been getting a little bit more vocal lately. And one of the things that he's always had a passion for is making sure that there is diversity in the acting field, you know, that people of different walks of life get the chance to portray characters and things like that. And he's actually gone on to say that, you know, there aren't enough positions for poorer kids, you know, and that's one of the things that he enjoyed. That's one of the reasons why his doctor was portrayed the way he was because he wanted to represent that, you know, working class people, which is, you know, his accent is tied very strongly to the working class, that they can be intelligent and they can be important and that they can fill roles in society that, you know, they typically don't see on film because they're not, you know, educated Londoners that, you know, have a very specific way of talking. And then, so he keeps advocating for this. And I am fully in support of what he's saying here, that, you know, you need diversity, not just race or sex or anything like that, but people from different walks of life.
Mm-hmm. It's something where, you know, you think about, and his argument is that in a lot of instances, so many of the primary BBC and related roles that are coming out specifically from the UK, as he sees it, are all sort of falling within the same actor casting archetypes. They may be actors who are versatile enough to put on affectations, mm-hmm. to portray other regions, other nationalities or what have you, but it all ends up the underlying talent pool is still very limited and there's no reason for it.
Yeah, because if they do get a job acting, it's, you know, it's the thug or the, you know, the working class Joe that doesn't understand what's going on. And it's, they get very typecast because of where they come from in life.
Right. Right. So the whole idea is, you know, that there's going to be no opportunities for them to be able it's sort of a matter of, you don't even know what opportunities you're denying yourself from a casting agent's perspective or from a casting director's perspective, because you're not even giving them the opportunity to step forward and prove that they have either the capability to, you could be surprised enough to have a Northerner who could put on an erudite accent and do a fairer job than somebody who just came in from the West End. You know, it's just a matter of being open to these additional opportunities or being able to be willing to be exposed to these other alternatives and to give the opportunity for a great talent pool to show what they're capable of, because they're never given the break. So it's absolutely, you know, I think we're all in agreement that it's something that needs to be heard and needs to be heeded. I wish there were more actors speaking up in this regard, the way Eccleston does. And he's probably not alone, but it's good to know that of all the things that he chooses to get press over, it's causes such as this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this isn't the first time we've heard him say something along these lines.
No. Mm. Interestingly enough, it typically kind of follows the whole question of why did you leave Doctor Who? So it's almost as if he understands people want to know. So I'm willing to talk about that a little bit to get the chance to go into this. So right. I'm ecstatic about that, because that's, you know, the fact that he's not shying away from it anymore, but instead turning it to his own advantage. Good on you. I like that. So, and then the last little bit of news that we got, unfortunately, the Doctor Who Symphonic Spectacular shows for New York on October 7th have been canceled.
No details as to why just yet. A number of us ticket holders had gotten the email a little earlier today that just said that they'd been canceled. There, according to any word that people have tried to dig into, there are no plans to reschedule the events. So refunds are being issued back through the Ticketmaster and online purchase transactions that have been conducted. So they'll just be automatically refunded to whatever form of payment you used. But yeah, both the 3:00 and the 7:00 that were scheduled for that day, no more. So if you're still coming to the city, let's go catch a drink or something, because we're obviously not going to be going to see a show. if we do find out any more, and I know, cause I was commiserating with Deb Stanish over at Verity, Andre, who we spoke to from Long Island, who was also affected by this too. We all tweeted within about 60 seconds of each other, what the heck is going on? I just got this email. What does this mean? To this moment, we still don't have any answers as to why. So yeah. Sorry.
Well, just take that money that they're refunding you and put it towards your ticket or, you know, expenses for LI Who.
Yes, buy more stuff at the charity auction.
Yeah.
For your bar tab for that weekend. You guys can all get together.
That's right. We have to buy Haley more drinks.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
If you're not already planning on going to that convention, shame on you and do it now.
Yeah. Your opportunities are slim at this point. So.
All right. Well, this has been episode 149 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, be excellent to each other.
And this is Kier saying, dust, wind, dude.
And this is Haley saying, strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.
He's been planning this for weeks. I know it.
The hell?
There he is.
Here, you broke the podcast.
I don't understand what's...
bye. Jeebus.
I'm just sitting here watching this thing fade in and out. All right, the rest of the news is all up to y'all. Apparently, my intertube says I should go to bed.